You're listening to the micro version of the Savage Lovecast, www.savagelovecast.com.
If you're stuck in a relationship quandary, or if you're looking for sexual harmony, well, there's nothing you can't ask on the Savage Lovecast.
I'm so torn. I want to open today's show talking about someone I hate. But God knows there's enough hate in the world, and I don't want to add to the sum total. But forgive me, I have got to get this off my chest. I fucking hate Melania Trump. I'm not alone in loathing Donald Trump's third wife. She's married to a misogynist, after all. Odds are good her husband hates her, too. But there are some folks on the left who not only don't hate her, they view her as some sort of sympathetic figure. The pretty princess in the tower, locked up by the orange ogre with the bad comb over, a princess desperately blinking out distress signals during swearing-in ceremonies and inaugural balls. I think we can credit that undeservedly charitable view of our new First Lady to our propensity as humans, as a species, to think that the insides of pretty people match the outsides of pretty people. And that may be true sometimes, but only randomly, and everyone, always beware of confirmation bias. And you know what? It's definitely not true in this case. Mrs. Trump, Melania Trump, is as ugly on the inside as she is pretty on the outside. She is a birther. Pretty Melania went on TV to push the same racist conspiracy theories about Barack Obama that her husband did. She's an immigrant who doesn't give a shit about the plight of other immigrants. She's famously a plagiarist, and she's brought ruinous lawsuits against journalists and bloggers, accusing them, amongst other things, of potentially interfering with her ability to profit off her role as First Lady. I don't know if you can impeach a First Lady or how that would work, but I do know that we would have found out pretty fucking fast if Michelle Obama had said the same during her husband's presidency. I had plenty of reasons to hate Melania before reading this by Kira Lerner at Think Progress. First Lady Melania Trump paid a visit to Children's Hospital in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday, where she called on the power of nature to heal seriously ill children. As her husband plans to repeal the Affordable Care Act, a move that could strip health care coverage from up to 13 million children, Melania Trump talked with patients and their families about how the gift of nature and the beauties of the outdoors can improve their health. You know what else improves the health of children? Medical care. And you know what makes it possible for children in the United States to access medical care? Not citizenship or residency or human decency. No, health insurance makes it possible for children to access medical care around here. Zooming back to a pre-Obamacare study, in 2009, Harvard University found that 45,000 Americans died annually because they lacked health care coverage. That's 15 9/11s every year. That number included, of course, thousands of children dying every year for lack of access to health care. Kids like Diamante Driver. He was a 12-year-old boy who died in 2007 because his family didn't have health insurance. The headlines read, "Toothache leads to boy's death," but it was really the lack of access to medical care that killed Diamante. Fewer kids are dying these days thanks to Obamacare, but Donald Trump and the GOP Congress are going to fix that. But even if it worked the way Melania Trump would like us to believe it does, even if nature and the outdoors were all it took to save Diamante's life or cure pediatric cancers, Melania might want to have a word with her loathsome husband about his environmental agenda. Her husband, while she's touting the benefits of the great outdoors, the health benefits of the great outdoors, her husband plans to gut the Environmental Protection Agency. Her husband has already signed executive orders rolling back clean air and water regulations. Her husband scrapped a rule that prevented coal companies from dumping toxic wastes into rivers and streams. So, kids in coal country might not want to go swimming. Kids all over the country are going to have to avoid beaches and lakes and rivers too, since Trump is zeroing out water quality testing. Because raw sewage and water can't hurt you, kids, if you don't know it's there. Her husband is also rolling back fuel economy standards, food safety standards, rules against pumping dangerous gases into the air like methane and sulfur, and scrapping good neighbor rules that regulate pollutants that float from one state to another. So, yeah, if you think the great outdoors can take the place of healthcare, you should be doing everything you can to protect the environment. And if you think we can't afford to protect the environment, you should be doing everything you can to make sure all people have access to healthcare, that everyone has health insurance. because children who drink polluted water and breathe polluted air and swim in polluted rivers are going to require more health care. But you know what? It's really not one or the other. We can have clean air and water and access to health care too. But we're not going to have either, thanks to loathsome Melania Trump's loathsome husband. All right, coming up on this week's show, on the Micro and the Magnum, the wonderful Lindsay Doe from Sexplanations joins us. Also, plenty of your questions, lots of my answers, all coming up. Today's episode is brought to you by Stamps.com. Stamps.com brings all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using your own computer and printer. And right now you can enjoy the stamp service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in my code, SAVAGE. That's Stamps.com, click the mic, enter SAVAGE. Support for Savage Love comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/savage. Today's Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Me Undies, high quality, super comfortable, good looking undies. Get 20% off your first order when you go to MeUndies.com/savage.
Hi, Dan. I'm a bi lady in my early 40s. I got divorced about a year and a half ago, and I'm just now starting to get back out there and date and have sex again. And I pretty much like having sex with people who I have a basic connection with, who I feel some affinity for and get on well with. And I'm definitely not into one-night stands or sex with random people who I don't know at all. And I find myself in a situation that is familiar to me, that I remember from the last time I was single, which was way back in my 20s. And it's that pretty much as soon as I start having sex with someone, I feel like pretty soon after that, like I'm falling for them. I feel like I fall in love really easily, even when that's not what I set out to do. And that's not what I want right now. I don't want a really deep, intimate, long-term relationship right now. But I find that when I start having sex with someone, I start imagining maybe I could have a future with them, or is this boyfriend or girlfriend material? And I have started to think that maybe I'm just not cut out for casual sex, because up until now, I just mostly have not been able to pull it off. But I'm a very sexual person. I love having sex. I want to have an active and thriving sex life. Sex is wonderful. I want to casually date and have casual sex, but I'm just finding it really hard to maintain that casual approach and to keep the distance that that involves. I fall in love too easily. Do you have any advice for me that how I can maintain the casual part of casual dating and casual sex and not fall in love so easily?
I know it's possible to reconcile these seemingly contradictory impulses, that you begin to imagine yourself having a future with someone that you're having sex with and a desire to have casual sex with someone, because I have that exact same, I don't want to call it a problem, I have that exact same superpower. I have had casual sex before I met my husband. I could hook up with somebody, although we didn't call them hookups then, we called it tricking. I could meet somebody and fuck them that night, but I couldn't have sex with somebody. I couldn't hook up with somebody if I didn't on some level think this person could be my boyfriend. If I couldn't imagine a future with this person, even if it was someone I had just met and only been talking to for a couple of hours, I kind of needed for that person to be someone I might think seriously about wanting to date or wanting to be with before I could take my pants off in the presence of this person. The way you reconcile these seemingly contradictory impulses, this propensity toward imagining a future with someone that you're fucking or about to fuck, and your desire to keep it casual, to have casual sex, is for your non-reptile brain, the bigger, stronger, more rational part of your brain, to come in on top of that and remind you that this urge, imagining a future with them, bonding with them, all good, all fine, but you know nothing about this person. You know very little about this person yet. And your imagination is filling in all sorts of gaps that makes them seem like potential terrific long-term partner. And they're going to reveal themselves to you over time if you continue to fuck them. You will learn whether or not they are a potential long-term partner. So you can bask in that good feeling, like, oh, potential boyfriend or potential girlfriend. Oh, love, love, love. I feel a bond. I feel potential. But you have to remind yourself that it is potential that you're feeling, not actual love, not actual, this is a relationship or could be a relationship, but you are sensing potential for a relationship if all the ducks continue to line up in a row, if everything falls into place. But at the outset, at the start, nothing much has fallen into place except an initial attraction and an initial good feeling about that person that you are then spinning out into a relationship, that imagined future. And it's fun to imagine that future. And it puts you in a mindset where if everything does fall into place, you will have a future with this person. But everything has not yet fallen into place. So enjoy the feeling. Don't view it as a problem. View it as a kind of superpower. Wallow in it while keeping your wits about you and being sensible about the fact that you actually don't know this person well, and something may emerge that disqualifies them from that imagined future. And you will then move on to imagine a future with someone else. Enjoy.
Hi, Dan. This is Ben in Denver. I'm a non-binary person who presents as male. I've gotten really good at online dating in the last 10 years. I think I mentioned I'm 29. And I'm wondering, I have this friend who comes over and hangs out at group stuff sometimes. And she knows I'm polyamorous, but we haven't ever talked about being interested in each other. But I kind of have a little crush on her, but I just have no idea how to bring it up to her and not be super awkward about it.
Be awkward. Embrace awkward. It is awkward. There's no avoiding the awkwardness. So just, if you're more comfortable with online communication, send her an email that says, hey, I mostly date through apps or date online, and so I'm reaching out to you online just to say, I'm kind of attracted to you, and I'd like to ask you out on a date if you'd be interested. And I realize that if you're not up for this, or you're not attracted to me in the same way, that this is going to screw up our friendship for a little bit. It's going to make it a little awkward, but we can burn through the awkwardness with some effort if indeed you aren't interested in me the same way I might be interested in you, and we can return to the friendship that we had once the awkwardness burns off. So what do you say? That's all you got to do. Embrace the awkward. Run toward the awkward. There's no avoiding awkward. Awkward can only be plowed through, not soared above. Support for the Savage Lovecast comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it is important to work with someone you can trust and someone who has your best interests in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you'll get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. Don't waste time searching through stacks of paperwork. With Rocket Mortgage, you can securely share your financial info to get a mortgage approval in minutes. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the mortgage solution that's right for you. Whether you're looking to buy a home or refinance your existing mortgage, you can lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/savage. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030.
Hi, Dan. I'm a 25-year-old female living in the Pacific Northwest. I have a question about what I should do with my ex-sugar daddy from college. He still tries to get in touch with me despite me clearly telling him that I would appreciate him not to text me. In college, he paid me to send dirty pics and give him hand jobs in hotel rooms. We always had a friendly demeanor when this was going on, and that money actually helped me stay in college while still being able to do my extracurriculars. I'm the first woman to have graduated in my family with a 4-year degree and then a master's. I'm now employed at a huge company, and the money that was provided by this guy helped me achieve all of that. So I feel like I owe him in some way, but when it came time to say goodbye, once I was on my own 2 feet, he took it really well. I said that I didn't want to have contact, and he understood. And things were great from there, and I was glad to put it behind me because although the money helped, it was still a rough situation, being that it was a huge secret and illegal. I was able to tell my long-term partner about the ordeal, and he's been amazing and loving and supportive. But for about a year now, my ex sugar daddy, he'll text me every few months or so asking how I'm doing, telling me that he's proud of me and asking if I still wanted to say hi sometimes. So far, I haven't responded to any of his texts. My partner says that answering the text is an invite to keep the conversation going, which I agree to. Normally I'd tell this guy to piss off, but I really want to maintain a friendly demeanor, and I'm afraid that if I use more stern language with him, that he'll do something unsavory. He's a married man in his late 70s with a huge company attached to his name, and I would die of embarrassment if my name and his ever got tied up together. So what's the best way to communicate to him to quit reaching out to me? I want to keep it lighthearted but stern enough so he stops. Should I just block the number and hope he just forgets about me? Please help, Dan.
The unspoken concern here is if you aren't friendly with him, if he gets angry at you for not responding to his texts, for not chit-chatting with him about how happy you are, about how proud he is, where you're at now, a place that he helped you to get to, although you describe his help as an ordeal, he might retaliate against you. And the obvious mode of retaliation would be to take all the pictures that you sent him over the years that you were in this sugar daddy, sugar baby relationship and release them into the wilds of the internet or send them to everyone at the company that you're currently at. That is, I think, the underlying simmering anxiety here. You know him better than I do, of course. You had these interactions with him for many years. Do you think he's capable of that? Are there revenge porn statutes in the states where you live and where he lives? If this got out, would it be as bad for him as it would be for you? Do you have emails and texts from him that could be damaging? Is this a mad situation, mutual assured destruction? He has these things about you and these images of you. You have what on him? I think you have to take all of that into consideration when you decide what to do about reaching out to him. I also think you have to take into consideration late 70s. You told him that you would prefer not to be in contact anymore, for both of you to get on with your lives, and you expressed gratitude for the help that he gave you, and hopefully he expressed gratitude for the hand jobs you gave him. Maybe he forgot. Maybe he's tiptoeing into dementia and forgetfulness in his late 70s, and he doesn't recall those conversations. I think you should send him one last text, telling him, reminding him that you need to get on with your life, maybe shifting some of the blame. Tell him a little white lie that it upsets your partner when you get texts from him because of your relationship. He doesn't need to know that your current partner is fine with it. You don't have to say your current partner is beating the shit out of you or freaking out or throwing things. Just that it upsets your partner. And so you're asking him as a friend, as an old friend with some history, if he can refrain from contacting you in the future out of respect for where you are now and the relationship that you're in now, and wish him well one last time and then block him. And your call, I think, for other people out there considering getting into sugar baby, sugar daddy relationships stands as sort of a warning that these things can follow you. And if you're in a position where this kind of commodified relationship could harm you in the future, or the scripts and scraps of it, the remnants, the emails, the text, the photographs you shared, if those things were made public by an angry, bitter, entitled ex-sugar daddy, it's something to take into consideration when you're deciding whether or not to enter into this kind of commodified relationship in the first place. Here at the Lovecast, we want you to look sexy. We just do. And the first step is really quite easy. You got to get some MeUndies. What are MeUndies? They're seriously soft, feel-good undies delivered right to your door. MeUndies are designed in LA and made from sustainably sourced micro-modal, a fabric three times softer than cotton. MeUndies softer than soft luxe undies come in an ever-changing selection of classic colors, bold shapes, and adventurous patterns, so you can tailor your undies to your own personal style. And you can save time and money each month with a monthly subscription. And if you're not ready for a subscription, that's okay. You can still save. That's because MeUndies is offering you 20% off your first pair. Just use our special URL, MeUndies.com/savage, and get 20% off your first pair. So go ahead, revamp your underwear drawer. I command you. Once again, that's MeUndies.com/savage. MeUndies.com/savage.
Hey, Dan, young man from the Pacific Northwest. I just had a quick question for you. I've been seeing this wonderful lady for the last 6 months, and we kind of broke up a couple of days ago. And she has three wonderful children that, you know, I would like to still be friends with, and I would also like to continue to be friends with her. But I was just wondering if you have any advice on how to sort of walk this tightrope of friendship without misleading anybody or making things more complicated. I just don't want to, you know, hurt the kids or hurt her or myself in the process by doing something that I would, that is unfeasible at the time. Maybe we should take some time off before we try this friend thing or not. I'm not really sure. I think we're both old enough to be mature about it, but I just was wondering if you think it's wise, or if you could give us some advice on how to proceed.
You say you're interested in pursuing a friendship primarily, first and foremost, with this woman's kids and also with this woman. You don't say whether she's interested in being your friend or you being friendly or a friend of her children. That matters not just as much as your feelings. That matters a whole hell of a lot more than your feelings. So I would encourage you to ask her how she feels. So you were only dating this woman for 6 months. You weren't with this woman for 6 years. In 6 months, perhaps to some limited extent, you were a part of the lives of her children as their mother's boyfriend. But I can't imagine you were so intimate and so folded into their lives that you disappearing after 6 months, although they may miss you, is really going to be experienced as trauma or deprivation. So my advice to you would be to back the fuck off, to not communicate with her children or communicate with her about her children, just to leave the ball in her court and say, the relationship didn't work out. Hopefully we can be friends in the future after that cooling off period that everyone needs. You kind of need to be away from people you've just ended a romantic or sexual relationship with for a while before you can establish that friendship. And if that happens in the future, if you two circle back and become friends, and you will re-enter her children's lives without having to force it. So, dude, just back the fuck off and let it play out. Postage rates have gone up again. That means trips to the post office are an even bigger hassle now because it's going to be crowded with people who didn't buy forever stamps who are having to top up buying more stamps. But thanks to Stamps.com, you do not have to worry about it. Just use Stamps.com to automatically calculate and print the correct amount of postage for every letter or package you send. Stamps.com brings all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using your own computer and your own printer. Stamps.com makes it easy. They'll send you a digital scale to automatically calculate exact postage. Stamps.com will even help you decide the best class of mail based on your needs. And Stamps.com saves you money. They give you postage discounts you can't get at the post office, including 3 cents off every first class stamp. Anything you can do at the post office, you can now do from your desk. You'll never have to go to the post office again. Right now, use my code SAVAGE, SAVAGE, for this special offer, a 4-week trial that includes postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in SAVAGE. That's Stamps.com, enter SAVAGE, and sign up today. With Stamps.com, you will never have to go to the post office again.
Hi, Dan. I'd be so thankful if I could get your advice on something that's really been on my mind. I've been going in circles, so I'm hoping you can help me out. I am a straight, single woman living in Canada. I'm in my mid-30s. And I decided a few months ago to conceive through artificial insemination. I have a known donor who is an absolute blessing in my life. He's amazing. He's one of my closest friends. If it's in any way relevant to your answer, he lives in the States, so he's not in the same city. And he's gay, so we've never had a relationship. Well, not a romantic relationship. So I've told the people that I'm closest to, like my family, my best friends, about my decision. And they've been so supportive and wonderful. And I have zero doubts about what I'm about to do. Everything is positive in that respect. It's part of a medical procedure. I've had to visit a psychologist
And her job was just to ensure that I really thought through all the different angles and aspects of my decision. Obviously, I had, but she did have one interesting piece of advice, which was to really be careful who I tell. Because I want to avoid this sort of earth-shattering moment for my child one day in the future when he or she realizes that every adult in his life knew who the father was or knew the circumstances of his of the conception. And, you know, I don't really know yet who I'm going to tell and at what age I'm going to tell the child. So it's a little tricky, and I totally understand her piece of advice. I guess my question to you is, if I'm not going to tell people the whole truth, and what do I tell them? Because God willing, I'm going to be pregnant very soon and showing very soon. And the truth is that I'm a private person and I'm not in any way ashamed of my decision. I'm really so excited, but it's a very private decision. And in my experience, when I have told people, the questions that I get, the follow-ups, tend to be really invasive. Like they ask me about his sperm and my eggs and my ovarian reserves and who's the donor. And the questions are, you know, they can get pretty detailed. And obviously my closest friends and family will know, or will be able to figure it out anyway pretty quickly. But I don't really know what to tell my acquaintances and the colleagues at work, because, I mean, let's be honest, it's a pretty juicy piece of information. It's pretty juicy gossip for work, and I know it's going to go around. And I really have no interest in being the subject of conversation. So how do you think I can minimize that? I mean, should I make up a boyfriend? Should I insinuate I had a one-night stand? I'm not sure that's realistic because it's really unlike me. And also, I don't really want to imply the kid is a mistake. Should I say it was my ex? Should I say it was an anonymous donor? I don't really know what to say, because obviously one day if I walk into work and I tell people I'm pregnant and I'm showing, they're going to say, oh, we didn't even know you had a boyfriend. And then I don't really know where to go from there. So Dan, what do you think I should do? How do you think I should answer the pretty basic questions that are inevitably going to come my way? How do I shut down the inquisition without seeming rude or withdrawn? Because this really is a very happy decision. I just don't know how to handle it.
Between these two options, which is likelier to get you gossiped about? You had a one-night stand and you knocked up and you decided to keep the baby, or in your 30s, you decided you were ready to be a parent and you were no longer going to wait around for some man to come along, and you went with a known donor, an old friend. And your kid is going to know their biological dad. Old friend lives in the States. I would go with the truth. Trying to keep track of who you've told which story, trying to keep your casual acquaintances away from your good friends and your family who may let slip the real reason, and then that's really going to be the cause of gossip, because it's going to look like you're hiding something and you have nothing to hide and you have nothing to be ashamed of. This is your route to parenthood. You asked an old friend to donate semen, sperm, and together you conceived. And if someone asks you a question about exactly how that conception went down, whether your old friend fucked you or whether it was a test tube thing or some sort of artificial insemination technique, you can just smile and say, that I'm not really comfortable talking about. Then they're going to assume that he fucked you, but you can say, I don't really want to talk about that. The really important thing is that I'm pregnant and bringing this child into the world, and that's a wonderful thing, and everybody involved, including the known donor, is ecstatic about it. Period. The end. And congratulations. Congratulations from all of us here at the Savage Lovecast on your pregnancy and the coming, hopefully, healthy birth of your child.
Hi, Dan. I'm calling to get some advice about porn, specifically about talking to kids about porn, and maybe more specifically, how to talk to younger kids about porn. I have two kids, ages 7 and 5, and I should probably preface this question by saying that we are pretty matter-of-fact about bodies in our house. We've taught our kids correct anatomical terms. We've taught them about good touch, bad touch, that the private parts are for them privately. My kids have seen my husband and me sort of getting ready in the morning. We're not prudish. We don't flaunt being naked, but we don't rush to cover up while we're getting ready in the morning. So our kids have seen naked bodies. So recently my son, who's 7, drew a comic book at school, and he came home and he was showing it to me. And he got to these few frames where he'd drawn a stick figure, and he said, and then he got all giggly, and he said, this is a woman taking a shower, and this man is watching her. So I sort of talked to him about consent, and it's not okay to watch other people naked if they don't want to. But then about a week later, I read an article that said that kids are first exposed to porn by age 7. And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm not ready for this. So I looked up advice on parenting advice sites, and most of the advice says, tell kids that porn is bad, that it's unhealthy, that it's wrong, that they should never look at it. And I don't really believe that in the context of a healthy adult relationship or sexuality. I think porn consumption, ethically produced porn, is great and can be completely part of a healthy sexuality. However, I do not think that's part of it for a 7-year-old. But I'm really kind of at a loss about how to go about addressing this with my 7-year-old.
Joining me by phone to help tackle this question, Dr. Lindsay Doe. She's a clinical sexologist and host of the wildly popular and truly wonderful YouTube channel, Sexplanations. Hey, Dr. Doe, how you doing?
Hi, great. Thank you for such a beautiful introduction.
I can't tell you how much I love your YouTube videos and love not just the content, but also the concept. It is kind of, it is kind of guerrilla sex ed that you're doing, and I have such respect for that.
Thank you.
You know, the sex ed the kids get in schools is so terrible and incomplete. And as I wrote in American Savage, it's sex dread, not sex ed, which is not an original observation of mine. I'm just amplifying it, that what kids are taught is to fear sex. I watched one of your videos where you talked about your own daughters going into sex ed and being told that they're not going to learn anything about masturbation, pornography, or what? And what was the third thing?
Contraception.
That's crazy. The three things
I
that
know,
kids
right?
are most likely to have questions about, the three things that they probably need to have a discourse about, particularly pornography and the way it can shape someone's expectations around sex, their fears about sex, and contraception, and masturbation. How can you not cover masturbation, which is most of the sex an adolescent is going to have?
Right, exactly. I'm glad we feel similarly on this.
So what inspired you to start your Sexplanations channel, besides terrible sex ed?
Yeah, the terrible sex ed was part of it. I was teaching at a university, and they were about to shut down the human sexuality class, and having worked there for almost a decade and seeing how much the education impacted the students, I went to the producer of Sexplanations and said, hey, we need to figure out another way for them to have access to this information, because they were going to remove it from campus. Another reason too, I was getting ready to adopt my daughter, and I wanted to, you know, to do something fun that would allow me to be a mom at the same time.
And to have a creative outlet, an outlet for all your awesome wisdom.
Oh, yeah.
Wouldn't want
it's
that
been
all
really fun.
Bottled up at home. Rattle off, if you will, for listeners who haven't yet landed on the Sexplanations YouTube channel, some of the topics you've covered.
Oh, gosh. The effects of porn, masturbation. We've talked to people in the sex work industry. We've done an episode on what we think the Disney princess sex lives would be like.
That was one of my favorites. Disney princesses, their sex lives are awesome. When are we going to get an episode about Aladdin's sex life? I know a lot of gay men who are particularly obsessed with Aladdin.
Ooh, I'll have to talk with John Cothart, the person who guest hosted with me. We did on that set talk about how interesting it would be to do the sex lives of Disney villains. But yeah, Aladdin, what do you think his sex life would be like?
Well, I can tell you what I hope his sex life would be like. And I can tell you what it would be like if he was having sex with me and was a three-dimensional human being and not a cartoon. But that would be giving away too much, and this show is not about me or my sex life. One more question about the concept. You know, I love guerrilla sex ed. There's a lot of really good sex ed out there on YouTube, and yours is right up there at the top, in my opinion. The one problem, though, is a lot of kids think they know everything about sex. And some kids have been convinced that if they go in search of information, that they're dirty sex perverts, and that's bad, that it's better to be ignorant. It's better to let things happen naturally, better to get carried away than to premeditate. And so a sex ed curricula that you have to opt into, which is kind of what Guerrilla Sex Ed Online is all about, is not going to scoop up those kids who most need it. How do we reach them?
I hope hope it does, though. I hope it's like the secret way that they can be curious and investigate without others knowing that they're doing it. At least that's my hope.
Do you get a lot of feedback?
I do get a lot of feedback in the comments or in private messages. People will let me know that they come from very conservative backgrounds or they experience a lot of shame around sexuality, or that they're very judgmental toward people who are sexually progressive or open about it, and that they kind of approach sex explanations in this secretive manner and just decided that they were going to do it and not let anyone know. And then as a result of that behavior, they really developed a different mentality about it. And now they're super supportive of the channel and the work, which is, you know, those are my favorite stories.
So let's tackle this question. Mom, two kids, age 7 and 5. And the kid, sounds like the kid drew a little stick figure drawing of something relatively innocuous, not quite porny. And mom went online, which everyone should do, go online so you can have a panic attack about the whatever it is that you're thinking about, and learned, and I am dubious about this, that kids' first exposure to online pornography comes at age 7. I have my doubts, but what should she say to her 7-year-old about the potentially pornographic image he drew of a stick figure watching a stick figure take a shower?
Well, first, I want to applaud her for being willing to talk with her kiddos. And then just understanding that the ideas around pornography do not all have to be negative or unhealthy, that there is a space for porn to be a useful tool in romantic partnerships or, you know, individually. And so go her. But also, I think in talking to the kiddo, what she gets to say is, where did you learn about this? Or what do you think about this? Or how does the drawing change in these circumstances? And really letting the kiddo lead and learn from the child, right? Like, my message on everything is to stay curious. And I think that that's where we get the growth that we need to have a healthy society, is when we don't act like we know everything.
I've often suggested on the show that parents need to have a dialogue with their kids about porn, as awkward as that might be, because the kids are going to see it. And you need to kind of get in between them and the porn. I frequently talk about, you know, my son before porn, when he was just watching TV, watching, you know, his Disney shows when he was 4 and 5 and 6 years old. And I would sometimes stand there and say, are you having fun? And he would say, yeah. And I'd say, well, actually, not really. You're watching other people have fun. It's kind of vicarious fun, but it's not fun you're having. You're witnessing packaged fun, other people's fun, other people having fun, and you're kind of enjoying their fun. And just by being a downer like that at those moments, it got it into his head that, you know, TV is fake fun. That's what he called TV for a long time. He called it fake fun, which was, I thought, you know, I gave myself a little parenting gold star at that moment. Not because
That's brilliant of you, Dan.
Not because we cut him off from TV, but we just put something in his head that helped him see TV for what it was. And we had similar conversations when he, you know, got to be, you know, of the age where it was appropriate, similar conversations about pornography, just to get in between your kid and the porn that they're going to view, so they're going to be critical about it and thoughtful about it. My kid became very thoughtful about how much TV he was watching and why he was watching it and what he was watching. And hopefully the same thing applied with porn. And I think those are important conversations for kids to have. But circling back to my original point, do you think that, is that accurate, that kids' first exposure to pornography typically comes at age 7 on average? Because that would mean that there are kids whose first exposure to pornography comes in utero, if you're going to average it out. Because there's some kids who aren't going to see porn until they're 15 or 16. And if the average is 7, then some kids saw it 2 years before they were born.
Ah, that's a great way of looking at it.
It just seems like anti-porn scaremongering to me.
Well, so what I've heard is around age 9, and I think that average is looking at the percentages of each age group. So it's not the, what is that called, the median or mode, but it's saying that if we have people starting as early as 5, 6, 7, and then the bulk of them are seeing it, say 11, 12, yeah, then you'll get that average. I do think that it's really early, and I, you know, cringe at the thought of my kiddos being sent material that they don't consent to, but I do think that it's a good place to have conversations about bodies and what people are doing with their bodies and what they are learning from that or taking away from it.
And what porn puts forward, what porn normalizes or centers, isn't necessarily what sex is with a partner. That porn is performance,
right.
Porn is kabuki, porn is action movie versions of sex.
And action movies don't look like life in the same way that porn, for most people, does not look like the sex that they're having as an adult with a partner that they're fond of.
Right, right.
And I think you need to say that to your kids. And I think seven is too young for a kid to hear that. You don't want to pique a kid's interest in pornography. You know, your kid, maybe your kid saw a little bit of porn, was exposed to it somehow. And I think if you go nuclear on your kid, it's going to make porn seem fascinating and something that drives parents around the bend. So you're going to want to be a little bit sort of even-handed and calm about it. You know, fact of life, porn exists. It's for adults. Kids don't understand it. There's really no reason for you to be viewing it at this time of your life. And some people never view it. Some people don't care for it. But, I, you know, you don't want to freak out. You don't want to shit your pants, mom, because there's nothing I think a 7 or 8-year-old enjoys more than seeing mom and dad have a heart attack about something. And you don't want to make it a button they can press so they can see your head fall off.
Right. Absolutely.
Dr. Doe, can you stick around for a couple more questions?
Yes.
Hey, Dan. I'm a 29-year-old single woman living in the far north. And I'm just calling because I've had a issue that's brand new for me. My husband and I have been married for 3 years. We've been together for 8, and we've had an awesome sex life the whole time. This last summer, I had a whole bunch of family problems and just a bunch of stuff come up for me. And it kind of threw me into a pretty big depression for the whole summer. And by the end of the summer, with the help of my husband, I finally started to get help. I'm seeing a really wonderful psychologist, and she put me on an antidepressant. And then I started noticing that I didn't want to have sex anymore. And last night, I tried to masturbate and tried to get myself off, and I couldn't come, and I couldn't come. And I looked up this morning, and sure enough, one of the side effects of my antidepressant is not being able to orgasm. As a longtime listener to your show, I know how important sex is to a marriage and to a relationship. So I'm just wondering, as a GGG wife and as someone who likes to get her own rocks off, what should I do? I really like how this antidepressant has been making me feel in every other way, but I also want to have that connection with my husband and make sure he's getting off. So yeah, just any advice that you have for me and what I should do with this issue, I would really appreciate it.
I'm always shocked when people call in who somehow missed the memo over the last 15 or 20 years that a lot of antidepressants crater people's libidos and interfere with their ability to climax. Mm-hmm. And I'm shocked that her, you know, this shrink she's working with that she seems to like so much didn't clue her in to that about that, didn't mention it. That's, I think, malpractice practically. Not malpractice, probably doesn't rise to the level of malpractice, but it's not best practices, I don't think, to fail to warn someone that these meds could crater their libido.
Well, you and I are very sex positive people, and I think that we are able to have those conversations with others. But I tend to see that in the medical field, where there isn't that push for sex positivity, that they overlook that their patient's sex life is secondary to their patient's psychological functioning. And so it's often not mentioned. I work with a lot of people who will come and say, oh my gosh, this is a side effect. What do I do? And my response to them is, you get to be the beacon who speaks to your professional and explains to them that this is a side effect of your medication and you need to look at alternatives.
Yeah, you need to look at alternatives. You also need to give people a heads up. You need to warn people, because if you're treating them about psychological distress or depression, and then you prescribe a medication that could really interfere with their relationship with their spouse or their partner around their sexual connection, that could create a whole host of additional problems in that person's life. I'm just really floored at this woman's shrink for not getting out in front of this. That this woman had to go online or read the side of the box to discover what the problem was with her inability to climax and lack of interest in sex. Really shocked. So what does she do? What would your recommendation be to her? What does she do now that she's on these meds? She doesn't want to get off these meds because they're helping her with the depression, but they're really hurting her sexually. What should she do?
I have a sexplanations episode that I really love called Dealing with Sexual Side Effects. It's all about this. I suggest that people learn why the med works for them, how it serves them, so that they can understand the chemistry of their bodies and then hopefully push forward to an answer and how that affects their sexuality. And then I also absolutely recommend that they are talking with their health provider to say, I don't want it to be either my emotional health, mental health, or my sexual health. What is the solution for me to have both?
Perhaps another medication, mixing it up, lowering the dose. These are options, correct?
Yeah. And right now there's this amazing test called pharmacogenetic testing, which allows the person in the lab to swab the cheek and actually find medications that will target what is going on. So they don't have to trial and error a bunch of meds and deal with all the sex side effects here or here or not here. Instead, they can really go for the ones that they know are going to work for the person and then look at what the sexual side effects are and work on either treating those or mitigating them.
So caller, you need to ask your shrink to watch Dr. Lindsay Doe's Sexplanations episode about sexual side effects and get up to speed.
Yeah.
Dr. Lindsay Doe, clinical sexologist and host of the popular, and please check it out, YouTube channel, Sexplanations. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I hope you'll come back and join us again.
Thank you so much, Dan.
Hey, Dan. I'm calling in regards to episode 540 with Randy Krager about borderline personality disorder. I'm a person with BPD. That's right, a person. Not a monster, as Ms. Krager would like to paint me. Not once did Ms. Krager mention that BPD is often brought on by childhood trauma and sexual abuse, or the fact that BPD can be effectively treated with a form of therapy called dialectical behavior therapy. No. Instead, Ms. Krager chose to focus on perpetuating the harmful myths and misconceptions surrounding mental illness, further ostracizing an already marginalized community. In this day and age, there's no reason why this should continue. Mental illness is unfortunately a part of our society, and our energies would be best used focusing on the very real treatments available rather than telling people to stay away from others with mental disorders.
Hi, Dan and Youth. I am calling with a comment about the creepy, sexually harassing karate instructor. I think you got it right. This cannot remain a secret. There's many children who remain at high risk. In addition to your advice, I would advise this person to call their county child protection services. A simple Google search, you'll get the number, and this will make sure that there are other people who are not involved in the administration who are also aware and will start some kind of investigation and also keep you anonymous, which sounds like is important to you. So please call your county child protection services.
Hey, Dan, this is a comment for the caller in the last show about the swinging couple. Problem is that they're trying to do it all as a foursome. They should switch to two twosomes, go off in separate bedrooms, and I bet that's going to fix the problem. The problem with a foursome is that it gets very competitive, and you're looking at where are they ahead, are they behind? Oh, my God, they've switched to oral. We're still doing kissing. You know, it gets to be a big circus. If you switch to two people in two different bedrooms, then it can be intimate, and you can discover what turns you on about each other, and I bet that's going to fix the problem.
And we're going to leave it there. 206-302-2064 is the number. If you have a question or a comment for a future show, give us a buzz. 206-302-2064. Be sure to listen to me, Eli Sanders, and Rich Smith blather on about politics almost every week at the Blabbermouth Podcast. Read Savage Love, my sex advice column, in Detroit's Metro Times and in other papers across the country. Follow me on Twitter at FakeDanSavage. Follow Lindsay Doe of Sexplanations on Twitter at LTD. That's at ELLETEEDEE. Savage Lovecast is produced every week by Nancy Hartunian and me and the tech-savvy at-risk youth and Nancy. We will all be back at you next week with another installment of Savage Lovecast. Thanks for downloading.